It's Daniel chapter 7, starting at verse 1. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream, and visions passed through his mind as he was lying in bed. He wrote down the substance of his dream. Daniel said, "In my vision at night, I looked, and there before me were the four winds of heaven, churning up the great sea. Four great beasts, each different from the others, came up out of the sea. The first was like a lion, and it had the wings of an eagle. I watched until its wings were torn off, and it was lifted from the ground, so that it stood on 2 feet like a human being, and the mind of a human being was given to it. And there before me was a second beast, which looked like a bear. It was raised up on one of its sides, and it had 3 ribs in its mouth between its teeth. It was told, 'Get up and eat your fill of flesh.' After that, I looked, and there before me was another beast, one that looked like a leopard, and on its back it had 4 wings, like those of a bird. This beast had 4 heads, and it was given authority to rule. After that, in my vision at night, I looked, and there before me was a 4th beast, terrifying and frightening and very powerful. It had large iron teeth. It crushed and devoured its victims and trampled underfoot whatever was left. It was different from all the former beasts, and it had 10 horns. While I was thinking about the horns, there before me was another horn, a little one, which came up among them. And 3 of the 1st horns were uprooted before it. This horn had eyes like the eyes of a human being and a mouth that spoke boastfully. As I looked, thrones were set in place, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. His clothing was as white as snow. The hair of his head was white like wool. His throne was flaming with fire, and its wheels were all ablaze. A river of fire was flowing, coming out from before him. Thousands upon thousands attended him. 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The court was seated, and the books were opened. Then I continued to watch because of the boastful words the horn was speaking. I kept looking until the beast was slain and its body destroyed and thrown into the blazing fire. The other beast has been stripped of their authority, but were allowed to live for a period of time. In my vision at night, I looked, and there before me was one like a son of man coming with the clouds of heaven. He approached the Ancient of Days and was led into his presence. He was given authority, glory, and sovereign power. All nations and peoples of every language worshipped him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion that will not pass away, and his kingdom is one that will never be destroyed."
We're going to carry on in Daniel chapter 7, so verse 15. I, Daniel, was troubled in spirit, and the visions that passed through my mind disturbed me. I approached one of those standing there and asked him the meaning of all this. So he told me and gave me the interpretation of these things. The 4 great beasts are 4 kings that will rise from the earth, but the holy people of the Most High will receive the kingdom and will possess it forever. Yes, forever and ever. Then I wanted to know the meaning of the 4th beast, which was different from all the others and most terrifying, with its iron teeth and bronze claws, the beast that crushed and devoured its victims and trampled underfoot whatever was left. I also wanted to know about the 10 horns on its head and about the other horn that came up, before which 3 of them fell, the horn that looked more imposing than the others, and that had eyes and a mouth that spoke boastfully. As I watched, this horn was waging war against the holy people and defeating them, until the Ancient of Days came and pronounced judgment in favor of the holy people, the Most High, and the time came when they possessed the kingdom. He gave me this explanation. The 4th beast is a 4th kingdom that will appear on earth. It will be different from all the other kingdoms and will devour the whole earth, trampling it down and crushing it. the 10 horns are 10 kings who will come from this kingdom. After them, another king will arise, different from the earlier ones. He will subdue 3 kings. He will speak against the Most High and oppress his holy people and try to change the set times and laws. The holy people will be delivered into his hands for a time, times, and half a time. But the court will sit, and his power will be taken away and completely destroyed forever. Then the sovereignty, power, and greatness of all the kingdoms under heaven will be handed over to the holy people of the Most High. His kingdom will be an everlasting kingdom, and all rulers will worship and obey him. This is the end of the matter. I, Daniel, was deeply troubled by my thoughts, and my face turned pale, but I kept the matter to myself.
Thanks very much, Ruth and Ben. Let me pray for us as we look at this passage. Father, you inspired Daniel with this vision and then to write it down. So please, by your Spirit, help us to understand what this means for us today. Amen. And for those of you who've been with us before Easter, we did Daniel 1 to 6 before Easter. And this bit after Easter, we continue Daniel. But this might be the bit where you're like, I'm not so used to this. So Daniel 1 to 6, you know, that's in the children's Bibles. There are statues and trees and lions' dens and blazing furnaces. And then you get to this second half, which is all visions and prayers. And the visions aren't just visions, they're strange visions. You probably noticed that. They're sometimes called apocalyptic literature, which basically means strange visions that mean something. It's harder to understand for us, but it's going to be good for us to go through Daniel 7 to 12, because these visions talk to us about what God is doing in a world of chaos and powerful nations. How do you live as a follower of God in a world of chaos and powerful nations? An additional benefit to reading Old Testament apocalyptic literature like Daniel and Ezekiel is that when you come to the book of Revelation in the New Testament, you'll suddenly go, oh, that bit is the same. It's sort of almost like God gives you the decoding bit in the Old Testament so that you can understand that bit of the New Testament. So, as we move from the history of Daniel to his visions, we are in the first year of King Belshazzar. That's between Daniel 4 and 5. It's probably somewhere around 550 BC. So Daniel was taken into exile around 605 BC as a teenager. He's been working in the Babylonian government for about 50 years. And he's probably just basically been forcibly retired because the new king doesn't like him. So he is a fairly old man, probably not quite so active in government at the moment. And he has a dream, a series of visions. And one of the things that's really helpful in Daniel is whenever he has a weird vision, he then gets to talk to an angel and say, what's that all about? It didn't make any sense. So if as you were listening to the vision, you went, that's weird and doesn't make any sense, Daniel agreed with you. And the angel's interpretation is right. In apocalyptic visions, the angel is reliable in the interpretation. And so what we're going to do is we're going to focus on verses 1 to 14, the sort of the first bit of the vision, and use the second half, the bit where he talks to the angels, the bits where the angel gives him the interpretation to help us to interpret that first half. But I'm going to focus on the first 14 verses, and there'll be some details from the second half that I won't get around to. So if you want to know every detail, I don't have the answers yet, and I'm focusing on the bit that I do understand. So let's turn to the vision. And before we do too much decoding, let's just allow ourselves to be immersed in the audiovisual experience of the vision. So you have Daniel on the coast, and a storm is coming. The four winds are coming. All the winds are churning up the sea. Think of those videos where you see a lighthouse, and the waves are crashing, and they're reaching almost to the top of the lighthouse. It's that sort of sea that's happening. In the Bible, the sea, from Genesis 1 onwards, it's not really a place for people to live in the Bible. It's a place of chaos for from which evil might emerge. And here it's in full chaos mode, with the waves towering over Daniel and us, and it's crashing down with immense force. And then out of the sea come four monsters, and each of them is huge. You're probably meant to think a bit like Godzilla or Jurassic Park. How would you feel if great beasts come out? So we're not thinking, you know, little fluffy baby animals. We're thinking monsters coming out of the sea. And each of them is a strange kind of beast. The first is like a lion, but with eagle's wings. The second is like a lopsided bear with meat dripping blood coming from its mouth. The third is like a four-headed leopard with wings. And the fourth, bigger than the others, is even more terrifying and powerful, and it has iron teeth and 10 horns, and it devours and it crushes underfoot. And they're stamping around you in the vision. And you're meant to feel terrified. Like, if you were there, if you can imagine yourself in the film at this moment, you would be terrified, you would be trembling. These beasts are not your friends. These beasts are not tame. They are terrifyingly powerful. They could destroy you in a moment. And so you tremble before them. So what is it that we're meant to tremble before? What is it that is a terrifying reality around us? We don't have to guess, because in verse 17 we get the interpretation. So Daniel says, what's the meaning of all this? He tells me the interpretation, verse 17. The four great beasts are four kings that will rise from the earth. They're four kings or kingdoms. And we've already seen something which had four kingdoms. We had a statue in Daniel 2, which each different part of it was made of something different. The head was of gold and silver and bronze and iron and so on. And each of them represented a kingdom, an era. And so here again, we get four kingdoms. And we can notice a few distinctions. The first, by parallel with Daniel 2, is probably Babylon. It's a powerful kingdom, the lion. It has ideas of being a universal or a divine kingdom. That's the eagle's wings sort of lifting it up above other kingdoms. But when it's brought down from those divine pretensions, it is the most human of all kingdoms. I watched until its wings were torn off, and it was lifted from the ground so that it stood on 2 feet like a human being, and the mind of a human being was given to it. Which reminds us of Nebuchadnezzar, who was a great king, thought he made everything, and then was humbled and became like a wild beast until he recognized God as God. The second beast is Persia. In fact, it's probably the empire of the Persians and the Medes, because the Persians have conquered the Medes. And that's why the bear is lopsided. It's a sort of dual empire, but one of them's in charge. The Persians are really in charge, but it's the empire of the Persians and the Medes. It's a devouring empire. And the third, then, is Greece. It's both the leopard and the wings emphasize speed, which makes sense when Alexander the Great went from being stuck in Greece to conquering the entire Middle East in about a decade. And the fact that it's got four heads points to the division of the Greek Empire after his death into four smaller but still quite large empires. And so the fourth beast is then presumably Rome. In Daniel 2, it's during the time of iron that the kingdom of God breaks in. Rome is the Iron Age kingdom. Jesus is born in the time of Rome. And yet there's something about this beast that's so terrifying, it feels like it's more than Rome. I mean, Rome was pretty brutal as an empire, but this beast is horrendously brutal. And so it seems like it might be not just pointing to Rome, but just to human empires at their worst, or to a worst empire that is to come at the end. In Revelation 13, it's this fourth beast that's used to depict the state opposing God and being a tool of Satan. We also have this little horn, this extra horn, and mostly I'm going to ignore that this week, because a little horn will turn up again in next week's vision, so I'll try and make more sense of it then. But it does give that sense of within an empire there are competing individual leaders. And often there are individuals who are not the great founder of the empire, but who are boastful and proud and destructive as rulers. And it's these boastful rulers who are particularly harsh to God's people. In verse 21, this horn was waging war against the holy people and defeating them. So we'll see a bit more of that next week. Just put that to one side for now. We're focusing on the four beasts as our main focus today. So they're four beasts. They're each different, but they all have some big things in common. They are all very powerful. They're all terrifyingly powerful. They are all beastly rather than human or divine. So in Daniel 2, you have this statue that points to empires having a certain dignity, a giant statue in the shape of a man. Here, Daniel 7 reminds us that all great human empires and enterprises have a beastly element. All human empires pursue and use power in ways that devour and crush human beings. All great human empires have exploited their own people with injustice and trampled on people beyond their borders to gain wealth. And so we're right to tremble at the beastly power of earthly kingdoms. We will see hope, that the whole vision is about hope for Daniel living in this. But before we find hope, we just have to look absolutely clear-sightedly at the immense power and terrifying brutality of earthly kingdoms. What we often want to do is we want to divide the world into good and bad kingdoms. And there's some element of truth in that. There are worse empires and kingdoms and better. But it's not just the Russians and the Chinese who are terrifying in the way that they treat human beings. Those are clearly empires, nations where if you're a believer in Jesus or you're trying to stand up for human rights, you will be aware of the terrifying power of the state and its beastly nature that it crushes people. In these nations, with so many resources to track and catch and punish those who will not support them, you see very clearly the beastly element. But if we think that Britain and France and the United States do not have a beastly element, we have been taken in. The Bible is opening our eyes here to go, every nation, every empire has a beastly element. There is no such thing as a purely good, great earthly kingdom. There are better and worse, even within those beasts in coming out of the sea. The first one seems to be the best. But all of them are beastly to some extent, and that affects where we put our allegiance if we are followers of Christ. Now, Daniel spends his life working for two of these beasts. He works for Babylon for most of his life and then sort of called out of retirement to serve Persia at the highest levels of government. So this vision can't be saying, totally avoid any sort of role with the state, any sort of involvement with the state. There have been Christians who have taken that view. The Anabaptists and were often pacifists. They said, you mustn't have any role in government. You mustn't become a magistrate or take any government position because the state is always involved with violence and evil. And so some examples of those might be the Amish in North America. Well, that's not what Daniel's example shows us. He serves in the government of a couple of these beastly empires. But it does warn us that we must not identify the kingdom of God with earthly empires. All states have beastly elements, using power inhumanely for pride and wealth. And the perennial temptation for the church is to become too closely identified with the state, to gain power at the expense of becoming corrupted by the beastly state. And sometimes, again, that's easy to see far off. It's easy to see when in Russia, the Orthodox Church is blessing the invasion of Ukraine. That church has gone wrong. It's allied itself with a beastly power. But the same is true when churches in the United States publicly declare one president or another to be God's chosen president. And it's uncomfortable for me that the Church of England is going to crown the King of England. There's the danger of church being too close to the government. So all states are beastly powers. They have great power, and they often can use it to crush their people. And to also, at times, oppose God's people. What I want to do now is to pause and reflect on what we've seen before we move on to look at the hope element. So what we normally do is sort of use this couple of minutes to talk to a person next to you, if you're willing to. And there's two questions. Why is it encouraging to see God's word describe human empires as beastly and powerful? So why is it encouraging that Daniel 7 shows us human empires as beastly? And how is it challenging that God's word describes human empires, human kingdoms, as beastly? So have a chat with the person next to you. Okay, let's just pause there. You can continue chatting about this after the service, of course. But any quick feedback on either what's encouraging or challenging about this idea of all earthly kingdoms are beastly and powerful? Anyone either encouraged or challenged by any of that? There's such a buzz in the room. I was maybe talking about something else. Bev, thank you. Thanks, Bev. Yeah. So we want our states to be good, but it's good that the Bible recognises they're not fully, and that we're allowed to say, even if we think our country is relatively good on the ranking, there's still injustice, there's still issues that need to be dealt with. Yeah, thank you, that's encouraging. Any other either encouragements or challenges? Kim? Yeah. So the Grey Wednesday, can you be depressed when you look at the news and think, has God lost control? What's going on? And then you go, no, God tells you it's going to be like that. That's encouraging. That the reality and that God gets there first, as it were, rather than being caught by surprise. Paddy and I were just talking about part of the challenge of this, which is perhaps depends a bit what you grew up reading and whatever, but Paddy in South Africa, for me growing up in the UK, the sense of, we're the good guys in the UK, aren't we? And so we're better than everyone else, and we're not like those other nations who are doing all the horrible stuff. And the challenge of going, well, no, actually, we might not be the absolute worst, but there's plenty of bad stuff in both present and past history to be reckoned with. And so the danger of too much pride, the challenge of feeling too much like we're the good guys as a nation. I'm sure there's more to be said, but I see time is ticking on, so I'm going to move on to the next section. So the beasts are truly powerful and terrible. They seem unstoppable for any mere human. What sort of person can stand up to the power of the state, of these beasts with all their jaws and teeth? But then Daniel looks up, and what he sees transforms how we see the world. As I looked, thrones were set in place, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. His clothing was as white as snow. The hair of his head was white like wool. His throne was flaming with fire, and its wheels were all ablaze. A river of fire was flowing, coming out from before him. Thousands upon thousands attended him. 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The court was seated, and the books were opened. You see, what seems so powerful on the earthly level has absolutely no impact to change heaven. In heaven, the Ancient of Days is seated on his throne. The Ancient of Days is God. He's existed before the most ancient days of history. But for us, Ancient of Days probably sounds a bit like someone who's very frail and been put in an old people's home. That's just sort of, our ancientness tends to get that concept for us. It's slightly rickety. We're meant to think instead of the king who has won his kingdom, but it's still in good health. Or the business founder who is still strong, mature, and he's now stepping back from having to run the business because he's got it all set up and got everyone else running it. He's sitting down on the board. That's the kind of idea. God established the world. He founded the world so that however far back you go, God is there, God is ruling. He's the Ancient of Days, but he's also present today in all his strength. He's not grown weary or frail. The eternal God is on the throne, and the beasts coming from the sea will be defeated. They roam the earth for their time. They try and build their kingdoms, but the Ancient of Days is seated in secure victory already. He is not threatened. And his clothing and hair is white, as a sign of his purity and goodness. The beasts devour and trample. The Ancient of Days is pure and good. But his throne, notice, is a source of fire, which flows out. In the Bible, God, the God who is light, is regularly represented as burning with fire in relation to sin. So if there's no sin, it's like God is the sunlight that shines out. If there is sin, it's like the light goes through the magnifying glass and it becomes a fire and it destroys it. So Deuteronomy chapter 4 and verse 24 warns God's people against sin, saying, "For the Lord your God is a consuming fire. Don't muck around with idols. The Lord your God hates them and he burns with anger against them." And so the God who is in heaven, he's not shaken by these wicked earthly kingdoms, by the beastly kingdoms, but he burns with anger against the wickedness of those who misuse earthly power. And it's like out of his pure anger against evil, it's like there's a lava stream flowing from the volcano of his anger towards these earthly kingdoms. They're going to be consumed. All evil is going to be consumed by the holy God's pure anger. And if you think, well, that's too slow, you know, the fire flowing out is too slow, and God seems too weak to really overcome, Daniel then sees heavenly armies around the throne. Thousands upon thousands attended him. 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. I think that's 100 million. I don't quite know how Hebrew multiplication works, but I think that's right. And that's about the population of the world in 550 BC. So, and Daniel wouldn't know about large chunks of the world. So what he's saying is there are more angels in the heavenly army than any earthly kingdom can put together with its entire population at that time. So it feels like wicked earthly rulers, whether at local institutions or great states of the world, they're just unstoppable. They'll get away with it. But here we see a heavenly army, vast, big enough to take on the entire powers of the world. And they're all just gathered round the throne to worship and obey the Ancient of Days. When he calls them for battle, they'll be there. But what follows is not really a battle. It's that God is so powerful, it's more like a court case. The court was seated and the books were opened. You see, God is not like in one of the superhero movies, gathering together the team that will be able to take on these terrifying beasts because he's outmatched by himself. It's more like God is like HMRC saying, it's time to audit your taxes and there's nothing you can do about it. God opens the books, there's a complete record of what's happened, and he announces his judgment. So when we feel weak and powerless to stop the horrible violence in the world, in Ukraine and Yemen and Syria and the Uyghur region of China and so many parts of the world, look up and see that God is on the throne. His ultimate rule is not threatened. He has power to stop wicked states. One day he will hold everyone who held power and misused it to trample others, to devour and crush human beings. They will all be held to account. The Nuremberg trials after World War II are like a picture of what God's going to do. In those trials, German officers and officials who've been involved in atrocities like the Holocaust were held to account and sentenced. And God is going to do that for every single person who wielded power in ways that crushed and devoured others. Look up and see that God is on the throne. Take heart if you feel trampled or devoured by wicked earthly powers. But even that, I think, is not quite enough to encourage us. And so we need to move on to one more thing. We need to see not just that God is going to win, but that we ourselves will win. And the way the vision does that, it is not just to point to God on the throne, but to point to the victory of the Son of Man. In verse 13, we see this mysterious figure appearing. "In my vision at night, I looked, and there before me was one like a Son of Man, coming with the clouds of heaven. He approached the Ancient of Days and was led into his presence. He was given authority, glory, and sovereign power. All nations and peoples of every language worshipped him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion that will not pass away, and his kingdom is one that will never be destroyed. So the Son of Man comes to rule the world, and almost incidentally, as a side note, in between the throne with the Ancient of Days and the Son of Man, that fourth beast is just destroyed. It's in verse 11, if you look. Keeps looking until the beast was slain and its body was thrown into the fire. Incidentally, God has a court case and the Son of Man appears, but it's not like it's a great effort. And so what we're longing for is for the Son of Man to come and sort out history, to bring justice to those who are crushed and devoured by human empires. And now, just for the last little chunk of time, we're just going to think, who is this Son of Man? The word Son of Man, and the footnote to the NIV tells us this, Bar Anash in Aramaic, means human being normally. And that's how it's often used in the Bible. In Ezekiel chapter 2 and verse 1, God says to Ezekiel, Son of Man, prophesy. He just means, you human being, do your job. So maybe it just means a human being. There's a human being who's going to come and rule the world. There's some evidence in Daniel to say that. He's not starting off in the throne. He's starting off out there, and he has to be brought into the presence of God. That doesn't sound like an angel or God himself coming out from God's presence. It sounds like a human being being brought into God's presence. But is it just a human being, or is it talking about a group? Because often in Daniel 7, the Son of Man given authority is paralleled with the holy people. So in verse 18, after the great kings of the world, it's the holy people of the Most High who will receive the kingdom and will possess it forever. Yes, forever and ever. So the Son of Man has an everlasting kingdom. God's holy people get the everlasting kingdom. And that might make us think, is the Son of Man a way of talking about the collective group? A bit like you could talk about Uncle Sam when you mean the United States, all the people of the United States. You can use a figure like that, one figure to stand for many. Or is it that the Son of Man is the leader of the holy people? A bit like in medieval England, England was the King of England. You could literally call people by the nation they ruled if they were the king. So individual versus a group, the holy people. Human, or is it divine? Because this Son of Man does things that no human does. He comes with the clouds of heaven. And in the Old Testament, the one who comes with the clouds of heaven is always Yahweh. It's always God. Deuteronomy 33, verse 26. There is no one like the God of Jeshurun who rides across the heavens to help you and on the clouds in his majesty. So he's coming wrapped in the divine clouds. And everyone else has to stand back from God's presence, but this human being is not only not sinful, sinful people can't even get close to God, but he goes through the angel ranks and all the way to the very throne of God, and he stands next to God and then gets to sit on the throne next to God, ruling the world. That's not what human beings normally do. That sounds divine. And most remarkably of all, in verse 14, he is worshipped. All nations and peoples of every language worshipped him. And Daniel is Jewish, so he knows you should only worship Yahweh. But here is one like a Son of Man, coming into the presence of the Ancient of Days and then being worshipped. So individual or a group? Human or divine? And it's all a bit confusing if all we have was Daniel 7, but then you jump to the New Testament and you find that Son of Man is Jesus' favourite way of describing himself. And that's particularly striking because in the letters, they generally describe him as the Son of God, but in Jesus' own self-description is Son of Man. And he really is God. He's God the Son become truly human. He really is one like a Son of Man because he's been made truly human. And he's done this to be the long-promised King of humanity. He's the one who represents and carries with him God's holy people, brings them to live with God. And after his resurrection, he comes into the Father's presence as a glorified human being, one like a Son of Man. And so it's as a human that he's brought into God the Father's presence and given rule. As the divine Son, he is always in the Father's presence. He already had the rule of the world. But as the one who has become human, he now receives it after his resurrection receives the rule from the world, and now is worshipped. It's in his humanity that the Son of Man, Jesus, is able to receive all these things from the Father and now rule the nations. And so we can be encouraged. Jesus was actually executed for claiming to be the Son of Man. We haven't got time now, but if you look at Matthew 26, you'll find that the thing that convicts him in the court is that he says, "You'll see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of the Father." Jesus makes this part of his title when he talks about his death and resurrection. He says, the Son of Man is going to be killed and then rise again. Jesus says, the Son of Man is going to come, and how you've treated him will determine how you're judged. Those who are ashamed of the Son of Man will be ashamed of them when he comes in his glory with his Father's angels. And so Jesus is this Son of Man who brings the victory and who carries his people with him. And that's wonderfully good news, because while all the earthly kingdoms are beastly, Jesus' kingdom is pure and good. Jesus' kingdom is humanity as it's meant to be, and divine. Jesus calls people into his holy kingdom, and he never exploits or crushes them. Instead, he's gentle and lowly, full of compassion. The kingdoms of the world say, "You who are low down in the kingdom, sacrifice yourselves so that the kings can live in luxury, so that the plans of the king can be fulfilled." Jesus says, "Come to me, lowly ones, and I, the king of the universe, will stoop down and die to rescue you." And so we can have confidence and rejoice when facing unjust and brutal earthly powers. He is the better king, because he is truly humane, truly loving. He has conquered death. He will share an eternal kingdom with his people. And so as we come to an end, the question is, have I received him as my king? Jesus is already enthroned. If the resurrection happened, and last week we saw some of the evidence that it did, if Jesus rose from the dead and is seated on the throne of heaven, nothing will shake his rule. He will come back and rule the world. And the question is, have I received his forgiveness and new life? Have I been brought into his holy people? Or am I still stuck with my greatest power over me being merely an earthly kingdom that will be destroyed by Jesus? If you want to know more about how you can enter Jesus' kingdom, please feel free to talk to me after the service or a Christian friend. If you have received Jesus, then take heart. The Son of Man really does reign. And he is good. He will crush all beastly earthly powers. And his kingdom is one where all injustice and struggle ends. Hold on to him and look forward to the day where he comes.